To you, man. That's right. I'm back. This is Mr. Talk on you are listening to Let's Talk on Blog Talk Radio. And my man, I see my man is in the house. My co-host Akeem, aka Cloud Nation Radio. So we ready to rock and roll for y'all today, man. We're gonna finish this week out strong. That's for sure. Today, man, we got two more giants to talk about. And Marcus Garvey and Frederick Douglass. And man, I'm telling you, this has been 1 week as far as titans that we have discussed on the show. And I'm telling you, I have learned a whole lot just by researching all these individuals. And it's just amazing that it's, oh my goodness, just the knowledge I have gained just by doing the research and listening to you, the listeners, on this show. So I want to thank y'all for that. And in fact, you know what? I'm gonna give y'all some love, because all right, I'm going to give y'all some love, because, you know, y'all deserve it just like we do, because, I mean, you know, y'all make the show what it is, that's for sure. All right, I do apologize for yesterday, but, you know, sometimes, I kind of operate on energy, you know, and I guess you can say insight or visions, you know, when certain things are given to me, I have to act on that, and I guess yesterday was one of those days where the energy was very, very, turbulent, you know, and low. And I had to take time to recharge, you know, my energy battery, you know, my spiritual battery. So, you know, that's why we didn't do a show yesterday. I do apologize. You know, I guess I should have announced it. But, you know, sometimes it hits you when it hits you. You just have to just ride with it at that time. But we back here today. The spiritual battery and the injury level is up. And, man, we ready to do some things. Now, for those that don't know what I'm talking about, you know, inbox me. I'll give you a little insight on how to get there, okay? And we gonna pray for you, make sure you get your energy level and your spiritual work together also. But, yeah, there you go, Divine Design. Energy was getting toxic. There you go. So, you know, sometimes you have to step back and recharge and cleanse that brain on there, so you won't become as toxic as that energy that was being put out. Okay? So that's why we didn't do a show yesterday. If that wasn't the case, you know, we'll have been here like always. So, y'all know, hey, that's the way it works, okay? Man, I'm telling you, injury is so good, man. I was trying to find some music for the day, And man, did I find some music for you. We got a nice jazz cut with some legends, man, I'm telling you. And this is longer than it normally is. This is going to be a 13-minute jam session. But I just couldn't cut it short because, oh, when you talk about legends, I mean, oh my goodness of jazz. Wow. You know, you got Eric Clapton, Steve Gadd, Marcus Miller, Joe Sample, and David Sanborn. So you know this is going to be like, hoo-hoo. And the title song is Put It Where You Want. And that kind of rides right into the end of this week's conversation. You know, all this information we got for you. We know there's those out there that's going to continue to be the fingers. We know this. We know this. But there's others like myself and, you know, Hakeem and others that's working toward being that fist. Understand? We working toward being that fist. You know, punching holes through walls. And, you know, when you do that, man, you know, you can put anything, you can put it where you want to. Because, you know, you got that kind of power. But anyway, so, you know, for you nasty folk, get that out your mind, all right? We not talking nasty today, all right? So, anyway. So that's where we at with the show. And, you know, if you want to be a part of it, no problem. Just give us a call, 347-838-8622. You can join us in our chat room, or they just log in to www.blogtalkradio.com/Mr. Talk. Also, let's see, you can email me, ericletstalk@gmail.com. Those are all the ways you can participate in the show, and we'll let you also we'll tell you again after the music is played. You know, I don't want to get talking too much because, like I say, this was a nice bit of music. So, and I want to go on and get it out and set the mood, you know, before we get deep into our conversations, because hey, it's Friday, man. It's Friday. You worked hard, you know, you played, you worked hard. So now it's time to sit back, relax. You know, you but some of you about ready to get off from work and just, you know, listen to good music, get your mind in the right frame. All right. So without further ado, man, since this is such a long cut from what we normally play, I'm going to keep knock it out right now. All right. So without further ado, y'all, here it is. The legends of jazz. Thank you.
Sample.
Joe Sample. David Sanborn.
David Sanborn.
Steve Gadd.
Steve Gadd.
Eric Clapton.
Eric Clapton.
Marcus Miller.
Marcus Miller.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. You've been a great honor.
See you.
Bye-bye. We'll see you.
Bye-bye.
Man, I told y'all that was going to be a jamming piece. Didn't I tell y'all that we're going to be partying a little bit with some jazz, man? Wow, man, I'm telling you, that was a nice cut. I told you it was a little longer than others, but, man, we had to hear that, man, because, man, did you hear who was all a part of that? Did you hear those names, man? Some of the legends, I'm telling you. Whew, for those that didn't, let me give it to you one more again. Let me do you one more again. We had Eric Clapton, Steve Gadd, Marcus Miller, Joe Sample, and David Sanborn. And it's Put It Where You Want It. Y'all say y'all going to look that up, man, because, oh, man, I'm telling you, that was a live performance, man, I'm telling you. But it was on, oh, boy, that was, man, I'm telling you. Now, that's the way you started off. All right. So, anyway, welcome back, y'all. I am Mr. Talk. You listening to Let's Talk on Blog Talk Radio. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It's Friday. And Friday, man, we talking about, Marcus Garvey and Frederick Douglass. Yes, we are. We getting those in. We got to get the shout-outs in real fast. We got our mentor, the writer, Antoinette, my chat room coordinator in the house, Divine Design. Guess 144. Guess 811. And then we got the cynical Pianki in the house in the chat room. Also on the switchboards, we got my co-host. We got Mrs. Talk. We got Anonymous. And then, of course, we got the cranky Pianki on the switchboard also. So we got a whole lot of stuff going on, man. So without further ado, man, let's go on and get on with this show. You know, y'all want to be a part of the show today, 347-838-8622. Email me, ericletstalk@gmail.com. Or you could also join us in the chat room, www.blogtalkradio.com/Mr. Talk in the house. And, hey, get there and do what you got to do. You understand what I'm saying? All right. So without further ado, man, let's go on to get on with the show. Let me bring my co-host in because I know he's been back there tapping his fingers and bobbing his head a little bit. I know he ready now. He got us. He wrote all his notes. So let's get him in here. Mr. Hakeem, a.k.a. Cloud Nation Radio. What's going on, man? How you doing? Happy Friday to you.
Oh, man. Happy Friday to you as well. Feeling great. Feeling at peace.
Yes, sir. I mean, when you get all those kind of cats together, man, it can't help but be a jam session, you know? I mean, good Lord. I'm telling you. So you ready for the day, man? I know you gave you an extra day to stock up on some information there and some knowledge.
Oh, yeah. I had a ball learning a lot of stuff about these guys and doing this research. Like you said, it's definitely been a learning experience to have to, you know, do research on these guys. So it also inspired some blogging. So I'll be doing some blogging based on some of the stuff that we researched that I learned.
Okay. All right. Now that's what I'm talking about right there. That's what I'm talking about right there. Some blogging. Yeah, I'm gonna do some blogging too on YouTube one day. I'm coming, though. I'm getting there slowly but surely. I'm working my way up. Oh, man. You know what I mean? All right. So, all right, y'all. Let's get on with the get on. You know, I don't have any pre-stories that I'm going to save all those some money because I got some good ones to talk about. And I know if we get to talk about the pre-stories, you know, we'll cut our time off with these two guys because we're going to work these two in today. If we got to go to the extra hour overtime, that's what we're going to do because I want to get these gentlemen in because these gentlemen, these two gentlemen right here, they packed a whole lot of punch. You know, I know we talked about Nanny Helen Burroughs and W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. But when you start talking Marcus Garvey and Frederick Douglass, these two cats packed a punch for real. I mean, these were not two lightweights by no means. And you know, yes, we need to bring him to the forefront. So you want to kick it off? Because I know I let you kick it off before I get started. Because, you know, we get going and forget about everybody else. So I let you kick it off and start with, okay? Go ahead. Take it away, my host.
Oh, no problem. You know, the first guys, you know, I just want to give a, like, real short entry on one of the guys first, and that's, you know, Frederick Douglass, who is definitely an interesting study. He was, I learned and have been hearing this pretty frequently, that he was born, you know, a slave in a slave, was called, I guess, a slave cabin. In I believe 1818, near a town of Easton, on the eastern shore of Maryland. For all my East Coast people out there, he was separated from his mother when only I believe a few weeks old, and he was raised by his grandparents. And at about the age of six, I believe his grandmother took him to the plantation of his master and left him there. Not being told, you know, by her that she was going to leave him, Douglass is believed never to have recovered from that feeling of betrayal and abandonment. But when he was about eight, he was sent to Baltimore to live as what was called a houseboy with Hugh and Sophia Auld, relatives of his master. And it was shortly after his arrival that his new mistress taught him the alphabet. So when her husband forbid her to continue her instruction, because it was unlawful to teach slaves how to read, Frederick, he took it upon himself to learn. And he made the neighborhood boys his teachers by giving away his food in exchange for lessons in reading and writing. And at about the age of 12 and 13, he purchased a copy of the Columbian Orator, which was a popular school book of that time, which helped him to gain an understanding and appreciation of the power of the spoken and the written word as two of the most effective means by which to bring about permanent positive change, which he returned to the Eastern Shore at about 15, and Douglass became a field hand, and he experienced pretty much most of the horrifying conditions that plagued, you know, slaves during the 270 years of legalized slavery or more in the Americas. But it was during that time that he had an encounter with the slave breaker, Edward Covey, and their fight ended in a draw, but the victory was Douglass. And as he challenged the slave breaker, he restored his sense of self-worth. And after an aborted escape attempt when he was about 18, he was sent back to Baltimore to live with the Auld family. And in early September, I believe 1838, at the age of 20, Douglass succeeded in escaping from slavery by impersonating a sailor. He also went first to New Bedford, Massachusetts, where he and his new wife, Anna Murray, began to raise a family. And I know whenever he could, he attended I believe abolitionist meetings in October around 1841, after attending a few anti-slavery convention on Nantucket Island. Douglass became a lecturer for the Anti-Slavery Society and a colleague of William Lloyd Garrison. His work also led him into public speaking and writing, and he published his own paper, better known as the North Star. He participated in the first women's rights convention at Seneca Falls in 1848, and he wrote three autobiographies. He was internationally recognized as, I believe, as an uncompromising abolitionist, indefallible worker for justice, and he also was considered an equal, you know, alpha, equal opportunity, and an unyielding defender of women's rights. So he became a trusted advisor to Abraham Lincoln, United States Marshal for the District of Columbia, Recorder of Deeds of Washington, D.C., and Minister general to the Republic of Haiti. So Frederick Douglass, I believe he died in the afternoon, early evening, sometime on February 20th, 1895, back at his home in Anacostia, Washington, D.C. That's the short version.
Wow. Yeah, that is the very short version for sure. Woo! All right, well, you know what? Let's get it on, man. Let's get on with Mr. Frederick then. All right, so Mr. Douglass himself, I mean, many categorize Mr. Douglass as one of the leading, how can I put it? He was called, many consider him the father of the civil rights movement. And this man, oh boy, I tell you, his journey was just a story in itself. But there was an instance where he, what else happened? He was reading with one of his the master's kids, and I think the mother or someone found him reading and told him that no, he could not read. He was not allowed. Blah, 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 blah. He wasn't allowed to read, and that and the master said, well, you know, if you're allowed to read, that's a dangerous thing for a slave to learn, how to, an educated slave. And that's when he took it upon himself to, as you say, teach himself how to read, you know, and educate himself, because he knew that was the way to go. But this man, he was a brilliant man, believe it or not, you know, and, you know, he was an abolitionist. You know, he fought for human rights, women's rights. He was an activist, you know, a speech giver, author, journalist, publisher, and social reform. And, it, you know, with the 4th of July coming up, you know, he actually gave a speech. You know, he actually gave a speech. And the speech of the speech is the meaning of 4th of July 4th for the Negro. And if you have not read this speech, man, I'm telling you, you need to go and look it up and read it, because, you know, it's just, whoo, it's amazing. You know, and the name of it, once again, is The Meaning of July 4th for the Negro. You know, and I'm just going to read the opening paragraph. Fellow citizens, I am not wanting in respect for the fathers of this republic. The signers of the Declaration of Independence were brave men. They were great men, too, and great enough to give fame to a great age. It does not often happen to a nation to rise at one time such a number of truly great men. The point from which I am compelled to view them is not certainly the most favorable, and yet I cannot contemplate their great deeds with less than admiration. They were statesmen, patriots, and heroes, and for the good they did and the principles they contended for, I will unite with you to honor their memory. Now, that's just the first paragraph, all right? But, you need to read it. That's all I'm going to say. That's just the first paragraph to give you a taste of the way he wrote at that time. But, man, I'm telling you, it's so doggy. And that's what Jed Clamper used to say. But anyway, so, you know, when you think of Frederick Douglass, you know, you think of, you know, you listen to the just the rudimental history that's, you know, given into the chat room. I mean, in the chat room, my goodness, I'm leading that room, in the classrooms. And a lot of information that they just will not give you. You know, little is it known, he was not born Frederick Douglass. His name was Frederick Augustus Washington Bailey. That's what his name. So, you know, who would have known that? All my years in school, nobody's ever said that. That was his real name. You know, and he chose his name from a character in Sir Walter Scott's The Lady and the Lake, a book. Imagine that. Imagine that. But anyway, let's get on with the get on. Frederick Douglass was a man, as my co-host said, that was a complex man, because he believed that number one, as everyone else this week we have discussed, believe that you had to educate yourself. You could not depend on anyone else to educate, to do the educating for you. You know, and you know, that goes back to the finger and the fist of Booker T. Washington. You know, you know, education is a great thing, you know, but man, I'm telling you, I'm just hyped right now, y'all. So I'm trying to calm down so I can get this information out, because this is a lot of information that that I want to get out today. Like I say, we got to run two of them in, so, you know, just give me a moment. All right. Now, Frederick Douglass, you know, he was also influenced by, believe it or not, black preachers, and he actually taught in the Sabbath school in Baltimore, you know, where he actually helped get his reading and writing together and speaking skills. Now, you know, at 20, he escaped north, you know, to Massachusetts. and this is one of the few people that actually, one of the few abolitionists that you can say actually has a family to go along with this. You know, so it's one of those things. And Frederick Douglass, you know, he was a hardworking man. That was he was. I'm trying to see what's going on in my chat room at the same time, so please forgive me. Okay. Now, also, you know, during Frederick Douglass' time, there were also white abolitionists as well as black ones. And what happens is, a lot of them had different agendas. A lot of them had the same philosophy of how the things needed to be. I guess that's a good way of the direction that things needed, that the society needed to go. But in the era, you know, everyone had a different way of how I wanted to see it, had a different thought process of how they wanted it done. And in a lot of time, you know, black and white abolitionists had a problem with Frederick Douglass. They really did. And, you know, and it was interesting because there was some abolitionist called Garrison. What's this man's name? Garrison. Yeah, y'all know who I'm talking about. Some of y'all doing. Lord William Lloyd Garrison. Now, this guy right here. See, y'all need to be taking notes now. William Lloyd Garrison. All right. You know, he was considered a professional radical. Okay. And he was one of the few white abolitionists who shouldered, you know, who actually published parts of who David Walker appealed in The Liberator. Now, when it came to Frederick Douglass, okay, oh, man, I'm telling you, I'm trying to get my thoughts together here. Okay. You know, Frederick Douglass was considered a sort of radical in his way, because he wasn't about the submissive way of getting what he wanted. Okay, he was about action. Okay, if we fast forward to Malcolm, you know, it means necessary. Let's make it happen. You know, so Frederick wasn't one of those type that say peace first and you know everything can fall into place. That wasn't the way it's going to work. You know, and a lot of the white abolitionists wanted him to take a more passive road to equality, and that is not what he was about, and he wasn't going to be about that. You know, and non-resistance, that was one of Garrison's doctrine was non-resistance. You know, basically what I just said, you know, let's not give no resistance, just let them do what they want to. And eventually, as we evolve in time and it goes on and we become more advanced, things will get better and, you know, everything will work its way out. Well, it didn't work that way. All right, it doesn't work that way. And we knew it didn't work that way. So, you know, it was one of those things where eventually they begin to bump heads on this thing. You know, they really begin to bump heads. And Garrison, you know, I don't know. Garrison was one of those guys that, you know, he had his own thought process. Now, the black abolitionists were actually living up north. You know, they found it difficult, okay, to abide by whatever doctrine there was to anti-slavery. And why would they do that? You know, why? You know, anti-slavery, look at that, up north. You know, this is really interesting. As I'm going back and looking over my notes, it's really interesting because it says, but over time, black abolitionists living in northern cities, living again with the daily emergencies of their lives of fugitive slaves, find it increasingly difficult to abide by any kind of doctrine or approach to anti-slavery. And to be a Garrisonian was to toe the line on four or five of these principles that Garrison advanced, not the least which was non-resistance and pacifism. See, once again, you know, we're talking, hey, they just lay down, man. Let them do what they're going to do. Eventually, they'll see the wrong of their ways and everything will be okay. You know? But that wasn't what Frederick Douglass was about. And I see my co-host put play something in the chat room. And yes, he did subscribe to William Lloyd Garrison's weekly journal, The Liberator. And that is about when, you know, a little ways into that is when they started having not seeing eye to eye on a lot of things. And not seeing eye to eye was, whoo, back in those days, sometimes it wasn't as good as it would be today. As in, not seeing eye to eye is a good thing today. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? But anyway, continuing on. You know, this Douglass man, he worked with a whole a bunch of notable abolitionists. You know, Wendell Phillips and Abby Keller. You know, he actually had a relationship with John Brown and his family, you know, but of course, John Brown disagreed with, but he disagreed with Brown's violent tactics also, dramatically displayed in Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. See, that's someone else we haven't even talked about. And I don't know if we get to talk about him, where we will eventually, but you know, Douglass, he was a very complex man. You know, as with everybody else, he started his own newspaper. You know, once again, it was a major force of African-American opinion. You know, and if you go back to Monday, when we talked about Nanny Helen Burroughs, you go back to W.E. Du Bois, you go back to Booker T. Washington's, and if you really take a look at this thing, each one of them were entrepreneurs. They just didn't sit and say, okay, this is what we're going to do. And, you know, they actually started papers to get their information out to the point to where each of them actually were requested by presidents. You know, precedents. And it's an amazing thing. But see, and all of them had the same fight in them. They wanted something better because they realized that the way it was, the society was going then is not the way it should have been or it was going. You know, Fred, man, I'm telling you, Frederick Douglass, you know, and if you go and start reading, reading his writings, even his book, you know, he has the autobiography of Frederick Douglass. That is a very, 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 very interesting read also, you know, and he had a couple of other other speeches and books he wrote also. But Frederick Douglass was a man which he started, basically he's seen as the one to start have started all the Civil Rights Act. Because if I'm not mistaken, he basically lived, lived before majority of the other titans that we've talked about this week. You know, and Frederick was the father, put it that way. He was the man. He was the man who started all this. But here's my question. Here's my question, though, because we need to spit out all this information. But my question is, Frederick Douglass, if you take a look at what Frederick Douglass thought and believed then, and say we fast forward it to the 50s and 60s, when the civil rights was really beginning to kick off, what do you think Mr. Douglass would have said if he was still alive during that time? Would he have been happy with what went down during that time? And would he be happy with the way things are today? Would he be happy with that? I mean, we could know many experts, historians, consider him the father of civil rights, okay? So if he is considered that, and we fast bring him to today's world, even in the 50s, 60s, would he be happy with what has transpired? That's the question I'm asking y'all today. I'm put that question out there. And if personally, if I had to answer the question, I don't think he would be happy. I do not believe he would be happy with the way things are. Hey, Renee, I see you out there. I ain't get a chance to yell at you. And then we got let me upgrade you. All right, I hear you. All right, well, welcome to the show, y'all. Would he be happy today with the way things are? I wouldn't say that he would be, because I seriously believe, and once again, this is my take on my opinion, all right? So I'm not speaking for everyone. I'm just speaking for Mr. Talk. I don't think he would be happy, because there is even more separation and division among African Americans than there was back then. You know, you know what, Pianki? I understand. They were mulattoes. I mean, they were very bright skinned, and you know, they could be passed on as, you know, they could pass. Many of them could pass for being white, and yeah. Okay, so what? As the other two mentioned, they're part of a white male father and a black. So, and your point was, in the bottom line, if they were a slave, I don't care who was, they were a slave. Whether you had you were the child of the slave master, you still was a slave. So, you know, I like it when we get stuff like that. Mulatto, they were mulatto. Oh, he was a field man. He was dark as that tar out there. What that got to do with anything? What does that have to do? And see, that same thought process is so prevalent in today's society among African Americans, is why we still are operating on the finger system. Thank you, Pianki, for bringing that up. You know, that is why we operate on the finger system instead of working on a fist system. The fist system. Now, I know y'all like, why he keep talking about these fingers and these fists? If you've been here Tuesday, you would know. One drop black rule your back. What in the world? Okay. Oh, my goodness. We have some interesting conversation going on in the chat room. So if y'all want to get in on the chat room as well, hey, come on. www.blogtalkradio.com/Mr. Talk. Man, y'all will see why I'm having to pause at some of the comments that's going on. But, you know, being mulatto, being yellow, being red bone, being I don't know what other terms y'all have out there, but that is a part of the mentality that has kept us so separate throughout all the years. Even when people like Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, W.E. Du Bois, yes, we know the majority of them were mulatto. They were light-skinned. And maybe that was a plan so they could step out and be in the forefront for African-Americans and women and minorities and things of that nature. Have you ever thought about it? We often say there's always a plan. We just don't know what it is. Have you ever thought about that? Is that was the plan? I mean, come on, y'all. But yet, once again, we've gone, instead of focusing on what this man stood for, we went ahead and decided that we want to focus on their skin color again. Once again, it's that poison and that toxic type of thinking that has brought us to where we are today. Nowhere. Nowhere. When are we going to figure it out, y'all? When are we going to figure it out? Yeah, I said out of yellow. I sure did. But anyway, you know what? I'm keeping it calm today, y'all. I'm keeping it calm. So, you know, if you have something to add, come on. Let's make some things happen. And on, you know, because we still got Marcus Garvey on deck. So, you know, let's get this talk out of the way. Hey, Lisa, welcome to the show. I don't see you in the chat room often. But anyway, kick some real signs. You know what? I'm not going to say anything. All right. So let me bring this call in right here. All right, caller 111. Who do I have here?
Hey, good evening. I mean, good afternoon. Happy Friday. You know, it's hard for me to call without something critical, but, you know, mulatto really doesn't, the term doesn't have anything to do with skin color. It's just.
Hey, how you doing, Beasley?
I'm good. It's just, it's one black parent, one white parent, basically. And it's like an old term. But it has nothing to do with, like, skin color. Like, you know, the mulatto, I think Frederick Douglass was darker hued, but he had one white parent. Mulatto is just one white parent, one black parent.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Beasley. I appreciate that.
Yeah, just one white parent, one black parent. And, you know, I mean, you know, people can come out any skin shade, you know, with the mixture like that. It's, you know, like the Cosby kids. Even though they had two black parents, they have kids all over. That's just how black folks are. It's how we come out, all kinds of ways.
Exactly. You know, so... What is your take? What is your take on Frederick Douglass? Go ahead.
He's a great man. All of these men are great men. You know, whether I can, you know, and as I'm older, I can understand their ideologies and why they thought the way that they did. And you know, this guy rose up from slavery. I think he taught himself to read and write. And became a major player out there. He was meeting with Lincoln. He was a forceful man. I think I don't know if he bought his own freedom, but yeah. I mean, come on, you raise yourself up out of nothing from nothing, and you make something substantial of yourself. That's the signs of a great man. Someone that's not going to be stopped. You can't help but tip your hat to somebody like that.
Okay, cool. All righty then. Let me ask you this. So if he was to be around in today's world, let's say go back all the way to the 60s up until now, would he be happy with the way things are?
You know, someone like him that was principled and stood on principle and probably wouldn't have bent too much for money or other practical reasons or fame, he probably wouldn't last too long. I mean, both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were killed before they were 40 years old. So, I mean, but to answer your question, probably not. Probably not. There's been a lot of gains, but there's still a big underclass, and it doesn't. And the underclass seems to be perpetuating this cycle. And there's a lot of factors out there that are promoting it, you know. So he probably wouldn't be very happy.
Okay. Well, thank you.
But there's bright spots, and there's blacks that are achieving in all types of areas and arenas. You know, Pianki probably could speak best on it than anyone. There's blacks achieving in every industry, just about every field. We don't hear about it as much, but it is going on. It is going on, and the opportunities. Well, I don't know. It's a tough economy, but the lanes are there. It can be done. There's things that can be done, and that race, being black, wouldn't be as much of a hindrance. But there's always been people that have broken through, even in our recent history, you know, fairly recent history. You had someone like Ralph Bunche, who was an educator and a diplomat who rose high in the United Nations. Dr. Charles Drew, who studied and understood plasma and did a lot of scientific research. So there's always been, and I wish there were more scientists and more statesmen today. You know, as I get older, I see the pathologies, some of the stuff that the youth and that even I participated in, and it's not always good.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
All of these men are remarkable men. Are remarkable men. Marcus Garvey, you know, I was just reading about him while you were talking. I mean, he was really an incredible. You know, he brought a case before an international court in Geneva.
Uh huh.
Yes, I mean, so he kept it going. I mean, some people are really dedicated. They spend their lives dedicated to their cause. Not as easy to do that today.
Well,
not that it was ever easy.
Uh-huh.
But look what happens. People get seduced. You know, people have families. These leaders, people get seduced by, you know, money.
Mm.
Can be bought off. And at the end of the day, you know, at the end of the day, I guess when it gets difficult, they look out for themselves.
Mm. Wow. You know what? You said a whole lot then. You said a whole lot then. You know, but so, I mean, why wasn't it as easy for them to become seduced by money or distracted things of their time?
That's because of their character and their principle. Because of their character. And I'm sure each of them, I mean, Marcus Garvey got in trouble for raising money for they railroaded him for raising money for a ship that was to take people back to Africa, even though I think he did build the ship, but he didn't have the ship already. And he was raising money to get it done, and he had a picture of a ship or something, and somehow they, you know, that crossed him up, and he ended up in prison for fraud. But and I'm sure W.E. Du Bois, I'm sure he had sponsors. They had sponsors as well. I think the Rockefeller sponsored Booker T. Washington. And I'm sure W.E. Du Bois had sponsors. So you know what? Maybe these dudes were seduced by the money too. Because they definitely had sponsors and they were funded. So maybe they're not as pristine, as pure as we thought. Now, someone like Marcus Garvey's a little bit different. He was, you know, he was more radical.
Mm-hmm.
He just didn't see it was workable here in America.
Yeah. Mm.
So he wanted to go back and repatriate Africa and build it all around Africa.
Well, you have to understand, Garvey, wow. Garvey was from Jamaica, though. So I think he had a whole different point of view than those that were born and raised here in America. Would you agree with?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh. Absolutely. He wanted to repatriate and go back to Africa. He didn't see it working. He didn't see the white power structure has ever taken the foot off a black man's neck.
Now we seem to be talking, getting somewhere. Okay, so
the other ones, Booker T. Washington. I mean, we know that he was, you know, into agriculture and blue collar work, and was agreeing to separation. And W. Du Bois was an academic.
Okay, great.
He's an academic that probably felt that you know that we believed in assimilation and you know education and assimilation.
Yes, and we've had we've had
those people all exist in the people that call into this show.
Say that again.
Those ideals.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there's people that have called in and participated in the show that have gone back to Africa to live.
But yes, you are right.
There are people that believe or that practice that getting back to the earth and agriculture and planting and raising food is a viable way, is a real good plan. There's people that. Well, not as many, but there's people that, you know, believe trying to work within the system that's here. That's what I'm saying. You see each of the characteristics of these men exist in people today.
Uh-huh.
Particularly even the people that call on your show.
All right. Sounds like a plan. Let's see. I got Pianki, but I don't know. My system seems to have frozen a little bit here. Oh my goodness.
I think that's a pretty good observation I just made. It just kind of came to me.
Did it now? It just came to you.
Well, and you know it's true.
True that. You're right. It is very true. Oh
right.
Man.
True.
Hmm.
So who's to say any of these people are wrong?
Well, who wants to say, you know, and that's the thing. Like I said in the opening of the show, none of them were wrong. You know, they may have had their different ideas or theories about, you know, how to get there, but all of them were actually working toward the same goal, you know. They just had, some was more radical than others. And I think that's
I'm speaking to the other callers, you know, that call in that I may disagree with, but I'm not saying what they're deciding to do when their plan is wrong for them. I just have to do what's right for me, and what I think is going to make work for me. And sometimes people, we get into arguments over that, and that's a silly argument.
That is
an argument I'm not going to participate in anymore.
All right. All right. Let's see. Hakeem, you got anything you want to get out there, man?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I found that was pretty interesting to me was when I came across the information regarding some of Frederick Douglass' views, particularly dealing with what was called the black suffrage. And apparently, President Andrew Johnson really didn't. I don't know if he didn't really talk about it or what happened with that particular situation, but apparently Frederick brought it to the attention of both Frederick Douglass and, I mean, not Frederick Douglass, he wouldn't bring it to his own attention, but he brought it to the attention of Andrew Johnson, President Andrew Johnson, and President Abraham Lincoln. And, you know, despite, you know, the victory that was won, I believe, during the Emancipation Proclamation in 1861, he didn't really agree. He didn't support Lincoln. Instead, he supported John C. Fremont, and it was specifically because of he cited that his disappointment that Lincoln did not publicly endorse suffrage for, you know, the black freedmen. And so he was real interested in calling out, so to speak, those who didn't want to respond appropriately. Either you were all in and you were fully for the cause in his mind, based on what I've witnessed, or you're not really with us. He didn't want you to give us a partial, you know, partial assistance, or you're with us part time, but you need to be full time with us, for us, or you're not with us at all. It seems based on his stance against Abraham Lincoln, because at that time, you know, because of what happened, a lot of people were celebrating Lincoln. And you think about some of the guys in the back, you know, behind the scenes, who actually brought the idea of freeing enslaved Africans at the time to his attention, were actually enslaved, you know, slaves that were on the, you know, running away from slavery, were the ones who presented it and negotiated that concept in the first place. So it's not like Abraham Lincoln was so for the people that he just made this decision on his own. It was encouraged by those who were affected by slavery, not those who profited by slavery. And that was it.
Okay. Well, what happened? I don't know. I got kind of kicked out here for a moment, but I'm back now. All right. I see Pianki. We got Pianki on the line. Pianki, are you there? What you got to add, man?
Oh.
Hey, how you doing, Pianki?
Turn it off of speakerphone. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I would just, you know, I made a remark about the fact that Frederick Douglass was born a slave because his mother was a slave. And I compared that to Martin Delaney, who was born free because his mother was free. That's the way things, status was. But the difference in the ethnicity of their parents, Delaney's both parents were African, and he proposed nationalism. Barbary proposed nationalism because he came from Jamaica, whereas Douglass was sort of like an amalgamist, as was Du Bois and also Washington. That's where the term cast down your bucket where you are. They figured that they would try to do things here. But Douglass, I wouldn't call him the father of the civil rights movement, though, but you could. Because, you know, the Republicans passed civil rights bill back in 1875. Matter of fact, the Republicans who passed civil rights bills as a form of Congress up until through Washington, then you would have, of course, the Democrats that started biding for the black vote with Kennedy and then Johnson. And Johnson's 1964 Civil Rights Act. So, you know, you guys are doing a very good job.
Well, why, thank you, sir. Well, I'm glad you think we're doing a pretty good job. So I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked Beasley. You know, if you were to bring Mr. Douglass here today, would you think he'll be happy with the way things have turned out? Or would he be, as Beasley said, you know, he'd be a little upset, or he wouldn't make it?
Well, I don't know what he, you know, that's like asking Muhammad Ali to come back and fight the, he used to have those computerized things. Who the Rocky, was it Rocky Marciano?
Uh-huh.
You know, people can compare what they know about the two, whether if one is still living or if none of them is still living, and try to lay down a scenario of what would happen if that possibility could even occur. So it's hard to say what he would feel like.
All right, let's put it this way. With what he felt and what he believed, what we know of what he supposedly stood for, and what we know of today ourselves, there's no way we can actually, put it, you know, try and see, you know, put a I guess you think about, you know, we can't say, okay, he may have felt this way. And there's no we can look, no way we can look and say, well
Douglas was an amalgam. Douglas was an amalgam, wanted to amalgamize. He wanted to unite.
Right.
Garvey didn't. Delaney didn't. Muhammad, I say Elijah Muhammad didn't. Malcolm intentionally did not. King did and did not. So you have different sentiments as history go on. You still got that today.
Okay.
Me myself, I follow the do for self tactics rather than amalgamating, because I don't, you know, I think that it's best to have and control your own. I've lived that. There's nothing like when you tell a person you don't need what they got.
Look out now. Look out.
When they come to try to persuade you into their form of thinking,
uh-huh.
and they throw the carrots out there and say, well, I don't need them. I have my own.
Okay. I like that, Pianki. That's pretty good. Okay. Hold on. Let me bring this call in, and then we're going to go ahead and then, since you brought up Elijah Muhammad, we're going to go ahead and hit Marvis Garvey. Because a lot of us say his teaching had an influence on the Nation of Islam. Let me open up this other caller here real fast. All right.
I had dropped by accident. No, I agree with what Pianki's saying. That's everything. That's some true freedom. That's true freedom. That's really what it's about. That's really what it's about. Is being able to provide for yourself and, you know, or whatever group that you're with, and you can stand up to people, and you can. When I was a kid, and all throughout my life when I was little, and I swear my grandparents and my folks were saying this from when I was a little kid before I can even really knew what it mean and before I even knew that what it came from. But they used to say, "Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that has its own." And they said that over and over and over again. And what it programs in you from a pretty young age is that, you know, whatever your folks got going on, your folks going on, or whatever anyone else has is theirs. Is that, you know, you've got to have your own.
Okay.
You've got to have your own. And that's strong. That will stop. That will... Pianki put it best.
But, I mean, does having your own, does it mean individually or does it mean as a group?
Well,
a lot of people
speak as a group.
Uh-huh.
But for me, it works, you know, individually or in a small, it works individually for me now. There have been times where I've had partners and I've worked in groups and I prefer it this way now. And I've referred it this way for a while. It's difficult to work in groups of people, and everyone speaks of it like it's easy, but it's very difficult. And I think for me, it's best that I have control, and that I'm able to produce, and that I don't have to depend on anyone, whether it be a partner or something, and that I make the decisions because I trust my judgment.
Yeah, I like what Beasley said, because he said something that was real key in there. He said that he prefers, and I think what's wonderful about, you know, when everybody is expressing their ideas and their views and things, is that when you hear that you know, then personalize it, it lets you know that it's okay to, you know, to have different views, you know, and I think to for example, to attack his view would be unnecessary, you know, and it's great to say, yeah, that works for you, but what works for me for maybe blah blah blah. So I think that's wonderful, and what you were saying about regarding like a lot of the figures that we discussed previously, many of them had those moments where they were into more of an individual movement, you know, you see it today, and then some people were more hands-on when it came to joining together. Go ahead.
You know, I look at the group success myself. That's how you're going to be recognized around the world. When you go around the world, your reputation as a group is going to precede you. People around the world don't understand or don't know much about individuals. Well, of course, and, you know, Muhammad Ali found himself over there in what was called at that time Zaire. And he was jogging around in the neighborhood. He turned off and he seen depictions of him painted on the walls and so forth. But generally, it's the group success that people look at. And we had, like I said, we had individual black millionaires before the Civil War. During the height of slavery and Jim Crow and de jure segregation. But when you look at the group, that's a whole different story. And I would want to see the success lies within the group. It takes individuals who are successful to spur that off, but ultimately you want group success. I mean, here in America, you looked at, labeled as a group. Believe it or not, there's many attempts to try to amalgamate you, to miscegenate you. When you go down to Mississippi, you find out they haven't worked too well. In other parts of the country, it has worked in some, mm-hmm. Minnesota, yes, but down in Mississippi, no, it has not.
Yeah, that's well said. And since we are reflecting on groups, I will like to add into the fold Mr. Marcus Garvey. I just wanted to do a real brief reflection on him real quickly as we continue. But, you know, during post World War I Harlem, he was considered considered an exciting place at that time for, you know, the African American culture. You know, you have poets like Langston Hughes and Counting Cullen, and as well as novelist Nila Larson and Zora Neale Hurston, and musicians like Duke Ellington and Billie Holiday. But in the midst of the Renaissance culture in New York and in Harlem, you had the arrival of a young Marcus Garvey from Jamaica who sees the attention of both white and the African American culture community with his powerful oratory and ideas about separatism. And during the 1920s, the UNIA, the foundation of Garvey's movement, became what, you know, some, I believe, historian Lawrence Levin has called the broadest mass movement in African American history. We know he was born in 1887 in Jamaica, which was then part of British West Indies. And as a teenager, Garvey moved from his small coastal village to Kingston, where, you know, political speakers and preachers entrance with their public speaking skills. He began studying oratory and practicing on his own, and you know, Garvey became a foreman for a large printing business, in fact, but a strike in 1907, during which he sided with the workers instead of management, derailed his career at the time. So the realization that politics was his true passion, it prompted Garvey to begin organizing and writing on behalf of workers. He traveled to Central and South America, where he spoke out on behalf of West Indian expatriate workers and the UNI, in fact, UNIA, I believe. You know, Garvey went to London in 1912, where he met a group of African intellectuals who gathered to discuss ideas like anti-colonialism and African unity. And returning to Jamaica in 1914, Garvey founded the Universal Negro Improvement Association, or UNIA. Among the UNIA's goals were the founding of colleges for general and vocational education, the promotion of business ownership, and the encouragement of a sense of brotherhood among the African diaspora. So during his trip to America, you know, Garvey encountered, you know, difficulties organizing Jamaicans, particularly. You know, the more affluent tended to oppose his teachings as a threat to their position. In fact, in 1916, Garvey decided to travel to the United States to learn more about America's African population, and he discovered the time was right for the UNIA in the United States. So as African American soldiers began serving in World War One, there was widespread belief that being loyal and performing their duty for the United States would ultimately pretty much result in white Americans addressing the terrible racial inequality that existed. Unfortunately, in reality, you know, African American soldiers, after having experienced a more tolerant culture in France, returned home after the war to find racism as deeply entrenched as ever. And so Garvey's teaching spoke to those who have been so disappointed to discover that the status quo still placed. And that was, you know, it was still in place after the war. And so Garvey established a branch of the UNIA in New York City, where he held meetings, putting into practice the order, you know, those oratorical skills and his style he had honed in Jamaica. So he preached a racial pride, for instance, encouraging parents to give their daughters black dolls and to play with. He also told African Americans they had the same opportunities and potential as any other group of people in the world. So one of the things he said was, "Up, you mighty race." He exhorted the attendees often. And Garvey aimed his message at all African Americans. To that end, he not only established a newspaper, Negro World, but he also held parades in which he marched wearing a lively dark suit with a gold striping and sported a white hat with a plum. And his relationship with W.E.B. Du Bois in particular, Garvey at times clashed with the prominent African-American leader of that day, with many, including W.E.B. Du Bois. And among his criticism, Du Bois denounced Garvey for meeting with the Ku Klux Klan members in Atlanta. At this particular meeting, Garvey told the KKK that their goals were compatible. And like the KKK, Garvey said he rejected miscegenation and the idea of social equality. So blacks in America, or what we prefer to say is Africans in America, needed to forge their own identity, according to Garvey. And ideas like these apparently horrified Du Bois. So Garvey was called the most dangerous enemy of the Negro race in America and in the world by Du Bois in May 1924 issue of The Crisis. Now, you guys, we talk often about the Back to Africa campaign, and Garvey is sometimes said to have headed a Back to Africa movement. He did he did not call for a widespread exodus from America, in fact, but in other countries to Africa. He did see Africa as a source of heritage, culture, and pride, and Garvey believed in founding a nation to serve as a central homeland as Palestine was for Jews. So in 1919, Garvey and the UNIA established the Black Star Line for the dual purpose of carrying African Americans to Africa and promoting the idea of black enterprise. I'm sure that word sounds very familiar to some. The Black Star Line was unfortunately poorly managed, and it fell victim to some unscrupulous businessmen who sold damaged ships to the ship line. Garvey also chose a few poor associates to go into business with, some of whom apparently stole money from the business. And Garvey and the UNIA, they sold their stock in the business by mail, and the inability of the company to deliver on its promises ultimately resulted in the federal government prosecuting Garvey and four orders for what was considered mail fraud. Though Garvey was only guilty of inexperience and bad choices, he was convicted in 1923, and he spent 2 years in jail under President Calvin Coolidge, which ended his sentence early. But Garvey was deported in 1927. He continued to work for the UNIA's goals for his exile from the United States, but he was never able to return, and the UNIA struggled on, but never reached the heights it had under Garvey. Any reflections on that? That was just—I know it was long, but it was actually a short version of Marcus Garvey's life.
Yeah, Mark. You know what, Marcus was another one of those gentlemen that had his philosophy and theory, and you know, he basically was willing to do anything he could to get to make that happen. You know, now, you know, you came up with a whole lot of stuff there, bro. And, you know, I went back to his corporation and the first ship, the SS Yarmouth. And he got that one September 1919. And he unofficially renamed the ship to the SS Frederick Douglass. So, I mean, that was something that was amazing in itself. So we kind of can see where some of his beliefs and philosophies came from, you know. But here's another thing with Garvey that I didn't know until I actually started doing a little research, that J. Edgar Hoover, you know, was also one of Garvey's biggest enemies. And we know all about Hoover. Hoover was one of those individuals that, you know, once you got on his bad side, it was just like, wow, you know. But anyway, you know, and it was interesting that, you know, because of this, the FBI established something we've talked about many times on this show, Interpro. Y'all know what I'm talking about, counterintelligence program, you know, to investigate radical national political groups for intelligence that would lead to involvement of foreign enemies with these groups. I guess, are they calling Africa foreign? Africans, huh? Let's see. According to FBI documents, one of the purposes of the counter-impro program was to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and otherwise neutralize the activities of the black nationalists. They wanted to prevent the rise of a black messiah. So, you know, when you look at just those two little pieces right there, that tell you, Garvey was on to something. He was on to something. When the people go to that extreme to slow you down or stop what you're trying to do, then you have to be on to something positive. You know, now as far as you know, the black African nation, you know, that's not as far fetched as it's still today. You know, because you still have those that's calling for that. And Garvey, many believe that the Nation of Islam and a Rastafarian nation took a lot of their beliefs and things and created those organizations as well. You know, based on what Garvey was promoting as far as, you know, individualization of the African nations. or the black people. Hold on, I got somebody want to come in real fast, so let me bring them in. Let's see, 626 Lisa, what's going on?
Hey, what's up? How you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Yeah,
good,
good.
Wanted to say.
Hey, how you doing, Sister Lisa?
Hey, I was just going to say, as Marcus Garvey goes, a lot of leaders like him, people like to label them separatists, when in reality they were just trying to survive. You know, it's a separatist to me means you all have everything is equal, but you still want to be separate. Marcus Garvey and other people see, you know what, things are not happening here. We need to bounce. And that's what he was trying to do. And I think today it would probably be more difficult to do that now more than ever, because I had said it previously, you know, nowadays we're mixed with so many different races and so many different cultures, we would have to take everybody with us.
Hmm. Good point.
I mean, Alicia Keys ain't going to leave her mama here. Holly Berry ain't going to leave her mama here. You know what I mean? If we're, you know, we have a lot of cultures and stuff going on, and because of that, sometimes that can shape our views about certain things.
You know, and that's some very good, that's a very good observation, Lisa. And I don't think, you know, when you get this putting stuff out, you don't really think about that. I guess nobody really thinks about it until the time actually comes to where that decision has to be made. You know. Now my question is, go ahead, Yankee, because I hear you breathing. Go ahead.
Well, Garvey never did. Well, first place, that's not really accurate. If you go down south, if you go down to Mississippi, you got some counties in Mississippi that's as much as 80-85% black.
No, that's what I'm talking about.
And
I'm talking
Garvey
about
never did have the intent on taking all blacks back to all African Americans.
I didn't say that either. I didn't say that, Bianchi.
Well, let me tell you this. There's a difference between blacks like Elisa Keys identify herself and objected black African Americans.
I know that, but in society, she's still considered black. And the ruling class right now are white people, and we follow their rules and regulations as of today. And
well,
they have
she considers herself a black woman.
Well, no, because we can label ourselves whatever we want. It's up to the people in power. They're the ones that have the last say. I could run around and say I'm a purple person. I don't have the authority
Can Alicia Keys call and identify herself however she chooses?
She has already done that.
But in society, they're not going to let her do that. Sometimes Holly Berry, you know, usually she says she's black. Sometimes she says she's mixed. Society considers her a black woman.
Mixed? I think puppies are mixed and drinks are mixed.
A better
term might be biracial. But,
I think we're all mixed, so.
Well, that's a new term about racial, but as I said before, you got people who
why don't you get with the times?
Yeah, you got people don't have to get with the times if they don't want to.
They don't have to.
That's what the difference is.
If Alicia Keys considers
herself black, that's perfectly fine. That's like some people talk about this. If black women want to marry white men, go ahead. It's quote unquote black is perfectly fine if they want to do that. Then again, you got some that don't want to marry not only whites, but don't want to marry the black women that married white men. So that's the choice.
People have a lot of issues. But, you know, I don't really subscribe to the one drop rule. I think it's a old mindset, and I think it was promoted. But that's what you're saying, it exists, and you're saying that you subscribe to it because the dominant culture.
No, it's not what I personally subscribe to.
All right, I hear what you're saying, but that's some really old stuff that was promoted by white racists and black people.
And the ones that are not racist, they still adhere to that as well. They're not doing anything to stop it.
Blacks subscribe to that themselves. You go into New Bethel Church there in Philadelphia, and you look at a picture of the congregations during the time of Richard Allen. He had the lighter-skinned blacks assembled in the front and the darker-skinned blacks assembled in the back.
Well, we do know that back in those times, the lighter skin, the more prevalent you were thought to be anyway. So that wouldn't be much of a surprise.
Yeah, and they also, right after the Civil War, they also had what you called the Brown Movement, where people that were quote-unquote mixed or biracial, they kind of distanced themselves from the rest of the black people.
Well, they still do that today. But to say that what somebody won't let you do is, you know, I don't agree with that.
Well, like I said, I can go around and say I'm purple. Society will say, no, you're a black woman. I cannot put purple on any form, and they're not going to let me do that.
I think it's ridiculous that Obama isn't identified and classified as biracial.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
I think it's completely absurd.
Obama said himself he was African American, right?
And that's how he identifies, but I think it's really absurd, particularly not just who his birth parents were, but how he was raised, how he came up. His father, who's black, African, Kenyan, was around till he was 2 years old. His father bounced. His father left. He only saw his father one more time in his life when he was 11. So culturally, the people that he was raised by are his mother and his grandparents, who were white and Midwestern.
Well, his mother put him up for adoption, didn't she?
I don't know that.
It's
the first time I've heard that.
His mama put him up for adoption.
When I think he may have been adopted by the Indonesian guy that he was close to when his mother remarried, but I don't think he put him up for adoption. I think he may have adopted him and claimed him as his son, but I don't think she put him up like, you know, adoption where she didn't want him.
Because I've seen pictures of them together and stuff like that.
Right. I read the book. I just don't remember that much.
Yeah.
But that guy, he was close to that guy. In fact, I remember when he was being inaugurated, and I think we were watching it, and I was talking with people online. And, you know, he has a sister who's white and Asian. That's his sister. That's his half-sister.
And
Malia and Sasha have Asian-looking cousins. She married an Asian man or an Indonesian man. Malia and Sasha have first cousins that are Asian. That are three-quarters Asian. But no, let me make it to my point.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So what the people were saying, and they were black people that were talking, they were saying, who are those people up there with the things? I was like, that's his sister and his family.
According to this article, Obama was put up for adoption, or nearly, according to the Guardian.
I was going to say, how'd she get him back?
She was ready to put him up for adoption.
Oh, yes, she probably was, you know.
Well,
to the topic of the show on the differences in between Garvey and the other three, Frederick Douglass, Washington, and Du Bois, there was a difference. It was Du Bois that sicked Hoover onto Garvey because he didn't like what Garvey was doing. He didn't like Garvey's stance of nationalism.
Yeah.
Delaney.
And he also
rose
talked
to
about Marcus Garvey, his appearance as well, Du Bois. He made fun of Marcus Garvey.
Yeah, he called him a monkey.
Yeah,
all those divisions. Then also, Marcus Garvey met with KKK members because they shared a similar ideology, and apparently he felt it angered the jury and the judge that were Jews that helped get him convicted. But also, when you say that W. Du Bois went after him, I didn't know that, but I know that W. B. Du Bois had sponsors. He had people that. He had people that he was a part of that he answered to. He went to Harvard. He could have been doing that. He could have been pressured to do that.
Yeah.
and that he went along with it. So, you know, the same things that went on, they've been dividing and conquering us forever.
Sure have.
And I think these guys are all an example. And now they stand out as icons, but I wonder what was going on behind the scenes. And there's probably a lot more. You know, when you hear people that are younger than you and they're talking about things that happened during your lifetime that you witnessed, so you just know more details and more facts and what really happened and what the story turned out to be.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were things that went on then behind the scenes and that it's not what we think that it is.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
There's more to it.
Yeah.
There's more to it.
Well, yeah. But, you know, and I think we did talk about where I think it was Du Bois who behind the scenes were actually doing the opposite of what he was speaking about, you know, during his lifetime. So you may have a point there, Beasley.
Yeah. All right. And sometimes too, when we quote people from the past, we have to really research them, because sometimes, you know how we say, "Ooh, I like Frederick Douglass," but maybe Frederick Douglass didn't like someone else. It's easy for us to quote Malcolm X. You know, we keep doing that constantly, but we never want to put their words into action, because it's easy for us to just quote their life story and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, it's no secret that, you know, a lot of them, you know, they didn't get along, you know, didn't see eye to eye on everything. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's not.
Oh, no, 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 not at all. But you know how they say, like, I would have been down with Malcolm X. It's like, man, please, you can't even go to the nearest mosque right down the street. What are you talking about? You can hang with Malcolm X.
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, well, I understand that, too. But, you know, sometimes they say out of opposition comes solution. So you just have to, you know, it gets to a point to where, you know, it's sort of like arrows or something. You know, everybody's headed in the same direction. They're taking different paths, but eventually it's going to meet somewhere where everybody meets on that one point, and and from there, that's when things are going to really start growing.
I don't see it.
And I was going to say that. I was going to also say that. You know, during the time when the UNIA was, you know, operating their shipping company, and when they established that trade and commerce between, you know, Africans and Americans and the Caribbean and South and Central Africa and Canada and Africa and also the Negro Factories Association, there was an interesting statement that Garvey made. I mean, that was made about Garvey. Regarding, it came from leadership in the NAACP at the time, and they were the ones that called him the most dangerous enemy of the Negro race in America. And Garvey stated that he felt that Du Bois, you know, in his opinion, was an agent of the white elite. And we recall in the previous shows that we talked about. The philanthropy and how, you know, there were, you know, people with deep pockets, the Carnegies, the Rockefellers and people like that, that typically poured money into the movements of some of those leaders as well. And so how they had different things that they did, but they did, you know, many of them received philanthropic funding from benefactors, from you know, wealthy elite.
Because Du Bois wanted to fit in, and Marcus Garvey didn't, and Du Bois felt that he was making it hard for the people in America, you know, as far as his rhetoric goes.
Well, Du Bois had made himself a self-appointed vanguard of quote-unquote black people.
Mm-hmm.
You always have these leaders that think that all quote-unquote black people are the same, and they are not.
Mm-hmm.
Garvey's movement sprung off of that of Colley House, whose membership was about 400,000. They say in one parade that Garvey put on that it was 10 miles long. That was about 200 and some odd thousand people. Then when the Nation of Islam came on around the time of Elijah Muhammad, they had
powerful.
A membership of around 200,000.
Powerful.
Matter
right.
of fact, the Nation mm-hmm. of Islam during Elijah Muhammad's time, his height, was the largest employer, it has been said, of black
oh, yeah.
people in America.
They still have factories to this day.
Well.
Yeah, but see.
I did want to add, too. I'm sorry. I did want to add, because I made this comment based off of some reference information before. But Garvey did say that regarding the conspiracy, the theory that he mismanaged funding and that he deceived a lot of people with the movement. He said that he was a victim of a politically motivated miscarriage of justice, and he appealed his conviction. But he was denied during that 1927 exile when he was imprisoned and then released to be exiled from America. So I did want to throw that in there.
He got a 5-year mm-hmm. sentence, and it was commuted by Calvin Coolidge, and then he left. But Mr. Talk said they were all working towards the same thing. It looks like they were all working. I mean, just thinking about Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, and Marcus Garvey, that they were working all for separate things, but what they were all trying to do was tap the same resource, black folks,
mm-hmm.
black people.
Yeah.
And that's where the conflict came into play. And I think it's real. I think it makes a lot of sense that that Du Bois and probably Booker T. Washington as well. I mean, when you take people's money, you're beholden to them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like parents do with children. You know, you have parents that will help their children, help their adult children, but they have say-so in those lives.
Yeah.
You know, they
in the NBA.
Yeah, they have influence. So Marcus
yeah.
Garvey was probably the freest one of the bunch.
Well, you had that bunch. You're right. But you have to also, I don't know if Cloud is going to talk about the people like Martin Delaney, who existed back in the 1800s, who did travel to Africa, Liberia. He was fought in the Civil War. He was the first major in the United States Army. Worked with Lincoln trying to draft blacks into the army, and we know why that was. But his idea was the same as Garvey was.
And you know
go
what's
back
interesting?
Africa.
Yeah, this is just on a personal note. You know, Marcus Garvey died in 1940, and that's actually the same year my mom was born. His first wife died in 69. That's the same year I was born. His second wife died in 73, and that's when my sister was born.
Wow.
Well, I met his sons. I spent some time with his son, Julius, over in Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Did you?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You know what else was
met a lot of famous people.
What is his son
doing
in Ghana?
Interesting? One of the things that was interesting too is during his work, you know, I don't know if you guys recall, some of you guys may know more, definitely more than me, but you know, during once he moved to London in 35, I believe, he collaborated with the segregationists and white supremacist senator Theodore Bilbo of Mississippi to promote reparations. During that time,
repatriation. I read the same thing that you read. It's not reparations, it's repatriation. He was trying to get legislation and money to send 12 million black people back to Africa. Not reparations.
Oh, yeah, I guess that was the reference that I used. It was incorrect. But the
repatriation. The words is real similar, but it means a different thing. What Senator Bilbo did, and I just read this just today, that he was trying to get legislation passed to get funding to send 12 million, you know, not only did he believe in segregation, he wanted to get rid of black folks. He was going to send 12 million, which is a lot.
Yeah.
Which is probably the majority of the population.
Did they try to do that after the Civil War as well?
Some people did that. They went and founded Liberia in 1870 mm-hmm. something, 1880 something.
From my reference, they called it the Greater Liberia Act of 1939. So that's based on the reference.
You're right. It's the same thing. He was going to ship them all out. I guess it served both of their purposes.
Yeah, Liberia was formed for that. Matter of fact, the Negro in America, quote, if you want today, is born with Liberian citizenship. One would just need to go claim it. They're the only ones that can become citizens of Nigeria other than Liberians themselves.
I saw a Vice show on Liberia and what's going on there now, and it's bad.
Mm-hmm.
Really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Really, really
but,
bad.
But Marcus Garvey, when he got out, he assembled a group of men, might have been some women in it too, and he basically locked them down for a whole month or more and taught them from A to Z the things of his experience. Out of that came a book called Message to the People, subtitled The Course of African Philosophy. It's a very good book. You know, he talks about even that your God should look like you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, very inspiring. Now, his movement never would have gained the popularity that it did no place else except in the United States. It wouldn't have, where he came from in Jamaica. Matter of fact, kids should throw rocks at him in Jamaica. But it just goes you to show the mindset based on the experiences
mm-hmm.
and the environment that people live under that shapes that mindset. And the mindset that was going on in America at the time, the experience that was going on, that is, with the riots, Red Hot Summers, East St. Louis riots, and all the other riots, and so on and so on and so on. And Garvey basically told us, you know, what more do white folks need to show you that they don't want you here?
Yeah.
I'm not trying to go back to Africa, but it's hard to argue with what they say, with what it says.
Yeah, that's true.
And you see it to this day.
Yeah.
You see it to this day, and it's been consistent throughout my life. I mean, just
it's
when
one
you
of
have.
Those- Yeah, like with my parents' generation, you know, you go and get a job, you're underqualified. So in my generation, you get a college education, now you're overqualified. So it's, you know what I mean? It's a lose-lose situation.
And you had other meetings. You had the meeting, the Mohawk Conference, which was convened back in 1875. First time, I think the second time, 1877, was convened by former President Rutherford Hayes. Where delegates from the United States met in Niagara, delegates even from South America, Brazil, on the Negro problem and what to do with the Negro, because the population was increasing. They had no more need for forced labor.
Oh.
And basically what came out of that meeting, and Brazil chose to go the route of assimilation and amalgamation. The United States chose to go the route of Jim Crow and segregation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Wow. All right, y'all. Well, we got about 5 minutes left, and we're going to get out of here on time. It's Friday. Let's go and sit out on the porch or on the bank and do some fishing or something. Huh? Recharge. But before I do, man, we're going to go and let y'all get y'all last words in. So it's been fun for sure. And we're going to start with the lady. Go ahead, Miss Lisa. You up.
Oh, this is a good show. I caught the tail end of it. Mr. Talk, I still listen to you. I just don't call in because I moved to another building now. And, you know, too many people and all that. So, but I still tune in. And, oh, and Beasley, I always listen to you on other shows, too. So, yeah, so this was interesting. And last night I went to a screening of a movie called Hidden Colors 3.
Uh-huh.
So I'll be, I have a show and I'll be talking about that tonight and what I thought about that particular movie. So you guys have a good weekend.
All right, well, what time is the show?
It's 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I'm out here in California.
Okay, so that's right, 9 or 10 my time. Okay, gotcha. Uh-huh. All right. All right. Well, thank you, ma'am, and thank you for listening and your support.
Oh, and the Pianchi, too. I haven't heard him in a while.
Oh. Yeah, he drops in and out when he's not in Africa himself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, ma'am. All right. Mr. Beasley, you up. Uh-oh, hold on. Let me open your mic. There you go. Up, Mr. Beasley.
No, this is a good conversation, and, you know, you learn, you know about these people, but, you know, this makes you dig and read a little bit more into them. And there's a lot of information on these Wikipedia pages. I mean, particularly about Marcus Garvey. He has a real long Wikipedia page. Also about him that transcends a lot of these other black leaders is that in Jamaica, the Rastafarians, they consider him a prophet.
Yes.
That he's a man of God, and that when he spoke of you know, of a great leader coming from Africa, that would be the Messiah. They used that as prophecy for who they felt Haile Selassie was.
Hmm.
You know, the emperor of Ethiopia. So yep. I mean, he was powerful enough, and what he said was powerful enough, and his works were powerful enough that he got on a different type of status, a much higher status. And I'm reading here about his conflicts with Du Bois. It was pretty nasty.
Yeah.
It was pretty nasty. They said it sounded like, you know, maybe sometimes, you know, a BTR show, the way they talked to each other. Press.
Okay.
Yeah. At any rate, have a good weekend. Catch you guys later.
All right. Have a good one, Beasley. All right, last but not least, Mr. Beasley, you up. I mean, I'm sorry, Mr. Pianchi.
Well, you know, it was a lot of Rastafarians that followed Garvey. Matter of fact, during the time of World War II, when Mussolini, the fascist dictator, when he was fighting, attempting to fight Ethiopia, you had blacks that wanted to leave America for the Pacific region of fighting with the Ethiopians. Abyssinia, they were saying. And you also had Haile Selassie called upon an African-American by the name of Hubert Julian to help him with his Air Force. Hubert Julian was scheduled to make a transatlantic flight 2 years before Lindbergh.
Hmm.
And when he did attempt it, his plane, you know, went down. He didn't get killed, but his plane had malfunctions and went into the Atlantic Ocean. During many of Marcus Garvey's parades there in Harlem, Hubert Julian used to fly over him doing stunts. So a lot of things was associated with, of course, there were the Black Star Nurses. We mentioned last time why come they came into existence, because regular nurses, when black soldiers would fail on the battlefield during World War I, the white nurses would step over them to go attend to the white soldiers. So they said, well, we need to have our own nurses. And, you know, that kind of rhetoric, and it wasn't really rhetoric, but, you know, we can call it rhetoric, is where people like Du Bois and the organizations that he was associated with early on, later on he would move away from, they didn't like to hear that. You know, it was a bunch of them that went to General Sherman and was complaining because blacks was not fighting on the front line. Well, good gracious, man, why would you want to put your sons on the front line of somebody else's battle? I really don't understand that. But the Boyce, in the long run, died a troubled man. He was very, very troubled because of the things that he come to realize. You know, one of the drawbacks of growing old is that at some point in time in your life, you become to realize and begin to reflect on your past. And you can see it much clearer at that point in time than you could when you're a young man in the midst of everything.
Well, thank you, sir. And that is a very, very astute point there you made, D.E.M. I wish sometime we use some of that logic in early parts of our life, and we'll be a whole lot off sometimes. All right, but thank you, Pianki. As always, good information when you want to put out there. All right. Oh, let's see. Next is my co-host, Mr. Hakeem. And, go for it, Hakeem. Uh-oh. Wait a minute. My bad. I got so used to hitting. All right. Go ahead, man.
Oh, wow. What a show. What a show. I'm just excited, and I'm appreciative, and I feel privileged to be in the presence of such a wealth of enlightenment, such a wealth of wisdom, and I love how, you know, this loving community begins to share their insight, their wisdom, and their experience, and they can bring such they can bring out and dig up and unpack, you know, the narrative and the legacy and the heritage in such a way that is beyond my young years, you know, in my ability to access something, whether it's through a book or through some technological device. There's nothing like living, breathing wisdom, open books. And that's where the many of our elders, our mothers, our fathers, and so on are. They are the modern day griots. They're the new day illuminaries. They are those beacons of lights that just champion such insight and such a wealth of information. And one thing I've been learning from getting the chance to, you know, do a little bit of research on some of these giants is that there is richness in our past, but there's also a clear path to answers and solutions on how not to fall into those same traps, how we can work better collectively and unified. One of the other things I'm excited about, I think, is like I said, it's this ongoing process of learning, ongoing process of being enlightened, ongoing process of just getting a chance to get insight from and pull from resources and sources that without a platform like this wouldn't be possible. You know, it's only so much you can get from Google. It's only so much you can get from your books, you know, because some of them are flawed. And so it's so much better. And this is why I appreciate, you know, elders in my own family, is it's so much better. It's better when you can pull from living, breathing griots, living, breathing historical context, those people who bring the history from yesteryear and bring it to today. And I'm going to walk away from this meeting today optimistic, because I know that we have these young people who are these blank canvases. And I'll give an illustration real quick, and then I'm done. Blank canvases meaning you had the story that recently came out with a young lady who happens to be, you know, of Anglo-Saxon descent who told on her babysitter who tried to blame a burglary on her African-American neighbor. When it came out, the story came out, it was actually her boyfriend, who was also of Anglo-Saxon descent. So, and she, you know, she was the same, the young girl, and she didn't look at the world through the same lenses as maybe those who are older than her. So she hadn't been intoxicated, or she hasn't been she hasn't been indoctrinated yet. And so I leave with optimism, knowing that the lot of the young people growing up today are more of a unified front, meaning there a lot of them that's coming up are still open-minded and objective enough where you can give them and share with them this rich information and knowledge that can cause positive change if we get it to them early, before they're indoctrinated and before they're the toxins and things fill them up with all this googly goop that turns them into people who become enemies instead of friends and loved ones and unify. So I bid everybody peace, love, and I wish everyone a blissful weekend until we chat again on the show.
Thank you, Mr. Cloud, and you have a wonderful weekend also. As always, a great job. Great job. If I don't have it, I know you do. That what makes it such a wonderful, wonderful thing. All right, and good luck next week. I know you'll be out of the net. So good luck with that going on, and we'll see you when you get back up in. All right, y'all. Woo, I'm telling you. Another one down. That's right. Another one down. So, boy, so much information this week. I'm telling you, it's like almost an overdose. Overdose of information. But that's good. Because, see, hopefully what we've done is not only giving you some information here on the show, but opened up curiosity within you to go and really take a look yourself at some of these individuals, plus others that we have spoken about, you know, during the whole week of expiation. And I think if we've just touched one person like that, then this week has been worthwhile. You know, it has been worthwhile for me personally, because I have discovered a whole lot more information that was out there that I was not aware of. You know, as I mentioned on Monday's show, you know, a lot of times we hear these names thrown up in conversations, and only thing we know is the general knowledge that everybody throws out about, you know, Garvey, Frederick Douglass, Booker T. Washington, W.E. Du Bois. Everybody know the generalization, the common stuff that we're told as we're growing up and becoming adults. But a lot of times we need to go back in and dig a little bit more. Remember when you was a kid, you see something sticking up out the dirt, you know, and you get a little curious. So you dig a little bit and it won't come up, and you see a little bit more. Then you dig a little bit more, then you see a little bit more. Then eventually, you just can't take it anymore. You just start digging until you pick up the whole piece. And that's what education and information is about. You know, we just give you a little piece. And hopefully that ignites enough curiosity to where you just want to dig some more and dig some more and dig and dig and dig until you have the whole piece right there in your hand. And you want more, though. Then you go looking for other pieces. that's what it's all about, man. You know, this week we discussed, man, five exceptional people: Nannie Helen Burroughs, Booker T. Washington, W.B.D. Du Bois, W.E.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, and Marcus Garvey. You know, and it's amazing, as we've said here on the show, all had their different philosophies as far as what they wanted to see done. They all had their different, and they all had their different ways of trying to get it done. But if you really step back and take a look at what they were saying and what their general premise was, it was all the same. It was all the same. You know, stop. Let us stop stop acting as fingers, start acting as fists. Yeah, I know you can accomplish some things as fingers, which is true. Socially, you can. Now look at your hands, because I know some of y'all are like, what the hands? Look at your hands. Socially, you can strive as a finger. Let's be honest. You take, put two of them together, they stick. You put two more together, they'll stick. All right. You know, but just as fingers, you try and punch something or put a hole through something with your fingers, you're liable to break your fingers. But if you take all of them fingers and that thumb, ball them up into one, now you got some power back there. And that's all these individuals were saying. You know, whether it was through entrepreneurship, education, segregation, that's all the basic premise was. Let's work together. Let's get the trades that we need. Let's get the education. Let's get the business. Let's self-empower each other and work together. And that way, we will be able to withstand anything, come out this hole that we're in now. Hey, it's all that simple, to me anyway. It's simple to say it. It's a whole different thing to do it. But we have to start somewhere, correct? Right. All right. Well, we know there are those out there that are going to continue to be fingers. And I'm not holding that against you. If you want to be a finger, be a finger. And that's great. But when that fist finally come together and start punching holes through things, don't be the first one on the knuckles trying to sneak in. All right? I know some of y'all missed that. It get to you eventually. All right, y'all. It's been fun. Monday. It's Monday. Mad Monday. Soapbox Monday. It's going to be Monday regardless. And we'll be here, you know, God willing. So I look forward to seeing each and every one of you. I want to thank everybody for joining us this week. It has been fun, you know, for the knowledge that you have shared with us. And also just for being here listening. You know, it's always great to be able to talk to somebody, for sure. Cloud Nation, once again, thank you, man. P. Yankee Beasley, thank y'all for participating in the Doe Lisa Effect. You know, great, great. All right, so I'm going to get on out of here. Just remember, keep smiling, show appreciation. Forgive with an open heart and make sure you're forgiving yourself first before you forgive anyone else. And the biggest and the best thing I always say, learn to laugh at yourself. If you can laugh at yourself, then everything else is gravy. All right? So until Monday, y'all, 2 p.m. Central, 3 Eastern, 12 Pacific, 1 Mountain Time. This has been Let's Talk on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Mr. Talk, for co-host Cloud Nation. Y'all have a wonderful weekend, man, and we'll see you Monday. We're out of here.